and written, perhaps so that I could discern every word without the ups and downs of his handwriting, or perhaps because he found it easier to write more when he could type. It didn't take more than reading a few words for me to understand that this was a departure from his usual way of speaking to me. This was raw and honest, sharing times in his youth when he felt lost and alone, his first trips away at sea, far from home and all he knew in the creeks and on the beaches of the Helford. He spoke to me of the pride he had for me and his belief in my tenacity and strength. I held the paper tightly, rereading words together in twos and threes so as not to get to the end of sentences, not yet. I wanted to savour every moment of this expression of love that was harder for him to show me face to face when the cacophony of our ups and downs would stand with us. I yearned to make him proud, and although I knew I always had, this letter was the tangible proof of it I could hold forever. I hadn't realised I had been missing the love and acceptance of my family so much until I read the letter, letting it wash through and warm me like a stiff drink. Then I carefully placed it back into the envelope and plastic shields of the Ziploc bags. It couldn't get damaged. It was too special. They all were. I could see the one from Mama in there. I wasn't ready for the emotion of that on top of Dad's right now, and my amazing sister had written me more than one. She had written one for me to open as I arrived, one for the end, and an extra one, which was for if I decided to come home anyway, even after reading everyone else's pep talks. This was called, "You're Coming Home, and It's Okay." Juiced up on love, encouragement, and a new packet of pain medication, it was time to think about moving on again. It was here in Harper's Ferry that our trail family, in its current shape, fragmented, and not before time in many respects. Moose and Granola had been distant and aloof with me in the past weeks, and they left the ATC for Washington, D.C., with their trail friend Shakespeare, who was completing a section hike. TJ and Wag had bonded hard and beautifully and were behind us now, after their trip to D.C., determined to do the four-state challenge together. So my tramily was now deliciously made up of Maple, Cruz, Chimney, and a new addition, K2, who had to finish the trail in time to make it to his wedding, a deadline that he seemed very relaxed about, repeatedly giving us anxiety for him and simultaneously making us hoot at the lunacy of it. West Virginia came and went without further fanfare, and then we were in Virginia, the longest state on the trail by far, and the one that takes more hikers off the path than any other. The Virginia Blues were a well-known thing for northbound hikers, who hit the steady monotony of hiking throughout this long stretch in one state. Southbound hikers didn't hit that state at the same point in the through as the northbounders, but we still experienced the same feelings when the exhaustion began to compound. Was it time for the Virginia Blues for me? Virginia, 550.3 miles.
I was just thinking that I'm a bit lonely. It's my second day that I haven't seen anyone at all on the trails. I get really lovely people messaging me on Instagram and Facebook, and that feels like company, which is really nice. And then I think, as much as I like my own company in real life, out here it's nice to know someone's around, like a few hours behind or a few hours ahead, and that you might see them at the end of the day. But there's no one. I have people like a day ahead, maybe a day and a half behind. This is a good thing to experience. Soon coming up is totally alone, in the dark, in the very cold, camping all by myself with no one else that I know around in a like 24-hour walking vicinity. Incrementally building up to these things, from being too scared to go for a long walk by myself, I guess, in some ways. All incremental. gold every day.
Chapter 19. The Virginia Blues. Early in my Virginia days, I knew that my foot was hurt more severely than I'd realised. I really didn't want to tell anyone, but mentioned to Maple at varying turns that I was in a lot of pain. This was familiar territory to me, though. Pain. I had many coping methods. Breathing in a particular way, disassociation, grit, and pushing through. And also, of course, the new stock of painkillers I'd picked up in the mail at Harper's Ferry. As much as I knew they weren't my friends, the meds were definitely making the day easier. Maple was, as ever, a supreme buddy, and offered to carry my pack as well as his own on the elevation where my full pack caused my foot to shoot pains up my leg and me to gasp out loud. We had dipped into Front Royal to get supplies for our coming days in the Shenandoah National Park, through which about 100 miles of trail meanders. I was so excited for the park and all the views it would afford, but had been told that the AT was routed through tree cover most of the way. If we wanted views, we'd need to hop on and off Skyline Drive, a route with the very best vistas that had been built for people to drive along, not walk. So be it. I was no purist, but I knew that for some amongst us it was going to be hard to equate their purism with also missing some of the greatest views on this part of the trail. I couldn't have loved the Shenny's more. There were regular waysides through the park, ranging from expensive bars and restaurants to more humble campgrounds with great basic facilities. We were able to resupply regularly, and our days together were filled with some of the greatest joy I experienced all through the trail. I had hiked long enough to know what I was capable of. I wasn't carrying so much stuff anymore. The packing of my fears had much abated as I'd learned and grown. The men I was with were like my brothers, and I felt such love and peace in their company. Maple, Chimney, and now Moon, a younger guy who'd stepped onto trail from nowhere and joined forces with us after taking a few weeks away from the trail on his earlier attempt. Cruz had been with us in the beginning, and I loved him still, but as we meandered through local apple butter festivals and dined at waysides at the request of kind and interested strangers, he felt the urge to move faster, and one morning had departed early and gone far, too far, for us to catch him for now. And so, the rest of us wallowed in our time together. My foot was given some breathing space at this slower pace, and we were all kinder to ourselves. We lay around campfires under the stars, slept outside together eschewing canvas, and shared our deepest fears and hopes in the cover of darkness and in the arms of the trees. I had never been so content as I was with these beloved men. Days later, and for all the fun I was having and for the rest it had got, my foot wasn't showing any sign of stopping shouting for my attention once I revved up the miles. So it was, with a heavy heart, that I called for a ride to get into the next town, Waynesboro, jumping a few final miles of the park. I was beginning to fear that my foot was getting worse and not better. I'd strapped it up with tape, but didn't know if the pain was worse because I was tired and run down, or if it just needed more stability in my light trail runners. The black bruising was fading, though, which could only be a good thing. My pack was lighter after 5 days in Shenandoah, so the weight through my feet was better. I knew that another zero was needed, and Waynesboro was the place to get it. As I waggled my phone in the air to get service alongside a road, I was passed by three hikers I didn't recognise, but whose names I'd heard on the grapevine. We chatted briefly, and in the course of the conversation, I heard words that stopped me in my tracks. "Oh, yeah," said a pretty girl with a small pack and fast-looking legs, whom I would later know to be Yalla. "And whatever mileage we're doing is nowhere near as full-on as that guy Buckshot. He was crushing it last night when he went through. He only stopped for a quick meal, and then into the night he went."
"What? Buckshot?"
The last I had heard, he was many miles behind with Captain and his gang. drinking, smoking, and carousing their way slowly down trail. But what was this? He'd struck out alone? Oh my God, would I see him? I was gripped with a panic that he'd gone past me already. I had been long waiting for the moment when he'd come up behind me on trail and have to go past. To have my moment to speak to him calmly, to thank him for how he'd spurred me on, but also give him a solid piece of my mind about his shitty treatment of women. Oh, but who was I kidding? It wouldn't just be that. Oh, I said, as casually as I could muster. Buckshot! I didn't realise he was so close. We were buddies back earlier on the trail. I haven't seen him for an age now. I tried to keep my voice light. Well, he's somewhere round here for sure, taking road through and not just trail. I'm sure you won't miss him. Just then, my phone pinged to tell me it had found signal. Okay, thanks, guys. Well, happy hiking and see you down trail. I have to make a quick call. And so they smiled and took their leave. And I called for a shuttle from the hostel in Waynesboro to come and collect me, now dizzied and my heart beating in my mouth, as well as thumping in my foot. Buckshot, I was going to get to say goodbye. I texted him as I got into town. It had been a while, and I was nervous to make contact, but this might be my last chance. He replied almost immediately, and with one thing leading to another, he arrived at my motel door a few hours later. He jumped into the shower, and we sat drinking cider on the balcony, chatting and laughing as if the down times had been a figment of my imagination. Minutes of anxious tension turned into hours of companionable catching up, and then dinner, more beers, and a night that transported me back to our earlier and most connected times together. I was under no illusion, however, that this was a divided man, in more than one direction, and I was a scarlet woman. I didn't ask if he had finally ended his long-distance relationship, because I knew he'd either lie or get cross that I'd asked. I hoped he had, but I knew the real answer. As much as I felt terrible spending this kind of time with another woman's boyfriend, I also couldn't quite compute that he was really taken. I knew she existed across oceans somewhere, but since I hadn't known she existed for so much of our time together, it seemed permissible for me to continue with this man who had meant so much to me, and that me saying this final goodbye was somehow okay. If it was the final goodbye, of course. Buckshot would not be drawn on specifics. Only that, of course, we'd be hiking together in the coming days, as well as many words of admiration and kindness about my hiking achievements, strength and courage to this point. He made me feel capable, and had done since the start. But I was aware this time around that I didn't need his words to feel the strength I had inside. I had become aware of it all on my own. After our night spent together, we resupplied at the store the next morning and I felt the familiar lurch of sadness as he packed in the motel room to leave. His transient nature was built so as to never get too attached. He'd already explained that he'd become so attached to me in the beginning that it had distracted him from all he was trying to achieve on trail this time around, speed and solo time. I would have liked to remind him that booze and weed had also contributed a fair amount to his distraction, but it wasn't the time or place, and I waved him off to the trailhead with some sadness, but also deep relief that the moment had come and gone, and now he was no longer behind me waiting to catch up, but ahead and pulling away. To that end, I hiked to the town's hostel where the boys had arrived and checked in, and we took a second zero altogether, feasting on an all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet and watching movies. Perfection. Our little bubble swelled at the hostel with the addition of baby milkshakes, who had slowed to hike some days with his mother and had ended up with us at the same place. After our time with feet up, enjoying the hot showers and indoor sleeping, we were fit to leave. I strapped my foot up as much as I could. Looking at it in dismay that morning, the puffiness creeping up my ankle and the bruising appearing at the base of my calf muscle. What was going on? I had researched online about deep bruising taking a while to appear, so that must be it. But it was disconcerting and extremely frustrating to not see healing happening. As I hobbled around, I was giving myself blisters and hitching my bad hip to compensate. It was not what my body needed or deserved, so I resolved to keep my gait balanced, bite down harder against the shooting pains, and ignore the snapping and grinding I could feel whenever I put too much weight on it. I would not be left behind. My bravado and positive thinking got me a fair way, still pulling long days with stiff mileage and enjoying myself. Hiking up the Priest was a slog as we just weren't used to such one-note elevation anymore after many hundreds of miles of more undulation than ascent. The climb was worth it, though, as the shelter atop the Priest was unlike any other, containing as it did a confessional logbook. Hikers had taken it upon themselves to reveal all to the Priest Mountain, and we spent a long time laughing our heads off at all the misdemeanors listed, from unclean hands on other people's food to coveting sleeping pads and peeing where they shouldn't. Many said that Virginia was long and dull, without the variation that one might feel when jumping from one state to another across state lines, but I was loving my time here. The terrain changed repeatedly, the history and sights were plentiful, and sometimes the landmarks were out of this world, like the sunset we saw at Lion Rock before spending the night there and making our way down into the next town. For me, though, Virginia was tough going, despite the beauty and wonder, and it was on the stretch down into the next town that I fell so far behind that I knew I needed to take action. I couldn't pretend that my foot was okay anymore. I called the closest hostel I could and explained my situation, to which they were very sympathetic, arranging a ride to the local hospital, local being 35 miles away, and sending the car to the trailhead for me. I limped there slowly, feeling deep fear that I was about to be told to step off trail and heal, words I was not prepared to accept. The hospital was efficient and friendly, and I didn't have to wait long before I was shown to a little cubicle. A nurse came to chat, and I found myself dissolving into sobs as I told her about my foot, my friends, my hopes of continuing, and how the pain had ground me into exhaustion. She listened and comforted me, explaining that they'd send a mobile X-ray machine to my bed, and then we'd see what was what. She asked if I'd eaten, and I replied no, amazed that I had actually hiked 17 miles without eating since breakfast. So focused was I on pushing through the pain. So, whilst I waited, a kindly security guard brought me two sandwich snack boxes from the staff room with a wink and a smile, whilst another nurse came toting some homemade soup she'd brought for her own lunch, and yet another with some herbal teas. I was being very well looked after. A quick zap from a fancy machine was next, and then, 45 minutes later, I was in conversation with the nurse practitioner who was parsing the X-ray results for me. No break visible, nothing out of the ordinary, don't worry. Thank God! I was advised to rest a little, perhaps to jump a couple of days ahead of my friends, to rest the foot whilst they caught up. Indeed, if it was a choice between going home or missing some miles to carry on with my friends, then skipping the miles it was. A stiff $1,200 later and I was out, back at the hostel in town and celebrating with the boys over the phone. They'd pitched up in the park down the road and were settling in for the night. We decided I'd catch a ride ahead of them and meet in Daleville, where we'd all catch up after I'd rested and take in the trail highlights of McAfee Knob and then Dragon's Tooth after that. I was so relieved to have a plan that the flood of joy and the course of heavy anti-inflammatories the hospital had given me for the next 10 days helped the foot feel better already. Tendinitis was the diagnosis, just an irritated tendon. Rest would be great, and then I could gingerly carry on whilst keeping the injury in check. Crisis averted, I tucked into a huge bag of Lay's and set about making friends with my new hostel mates in front of the TV, foot hoisted in the hospital bandages and my worries behind me. I got a ride from the hostel to Daleville with a member of the hostel staff, who was kind and thoughtful but couldn't stop talking. He took the wrong road because he was busy recounting one tale after another about how he'd had to get off trail in a previous year and ended up here working at the hostel, and so the trip, which should have been 45 minutes, became 2 hours or more. Eventually, I got dropped off where I needed to be and booked myself into the hotel across the way from where the AT picked up again. I was sad to miss Miles, but happy to wait for a day and a half and rest the sore foot sprain until Cruz and the gang hiked through to get me. I checked in and looked out of the window. Who should I see, tired and dirty, walking across the lot to the check-in desk, but Buckshot? Shit. Of course, he was ahead and was probably taking time out here for a night. I hadn't even considered that he might be here. I was too busy worrying about my foot and the potential of getting pushed off trail with injury. But I didn't expect him to believe me when he saw me. When we eventually bumped into each other in the hall, we reverted to the inevitable chatting, laughing and flirting that always rose up when we were together, especially when others weren't around. The chemical connection was undeniable, but I was trying to extricate myself from its hold over me because I knew now what he was capable of, and I needed to be free from thinking about him, and especially from thinking of him hiking on and leaving me again, despite the inevitability of it. We were both booked in for 2 nights, but we kept our separate rooms and didn't sleep in each other's spaces. The dance was still present between us. He backed off and I stepped forwards. I stepped away and he moved to me, but it was hollow for me and perhaps meaningless for him. I didn't know what we'd become now, but it made me sad that it was a far cry from our excitable closeness in the early months. However, I was now focused less on him and more on my foot. It had to improve. It had to. My trail family emerged from the woods earlier than I had expected. They had taken a shortcut and also really pushed the miles to arrive before lunchtime on the day before I expected them. So, with a little time to spare, they booked a room and gathered me up. We went to the Mexican next to the hotel all together and proceeded to drink huge margaritas and eat tacos and burritos until we were bursting. It was a lovely mix of folks, including old friends, Cruz and Baby Milkshakes, and new ones in the form of Pineapple and Yalla. Tipsy and happy, we piled into the hotel rooms together, filling the tub and soaping up both Cruz's airbed and my own to try and find and patch the tiny holes we both had that left us on the dirt in the mornings after slowly deflating under us all night. More beer, more fun, and then all crashing out in an exhausted sleep, ready to strike out again the next day, a full day earlier than my foot and I had planned. Before hitting the trail the next morning, I took an Uber down the highway to the post office and sent another parcel to Captain's parents' house. Such kind people. They had accepted packages from me of things I realised I didn't need to carry all along the trail. This was possible because they lived in Georgia, and I could collect all the parcels at the end of the AT before I flew home. I'd initially sent one box of things back to the UK, thinking it would work fine. But the customs duty my mama had to pay to accept it was triple the value of the junk inside. So I was forever grateful to Captain's lovely folks. After that was posted, I picked up a new pair of more sturdy shoes from the outfitter to help protect my tendonitis and ran into Maple at Bojangles. We hugged, delighted to be reunited after the past few days. Then Buckshot appeared, on his way to buy biscuits and liquor, and chatted but kept his remove as was usual. He wanted what he wanted, and to give nothing in return. Off we went. My bag was heavy and my new shoes weren't helping as much as I thought they would, but it was only 16 miles until we got to the stunning McAfee Knob for a sleep and to take a famous photo at dawn. Maple and Moon caught up with us the next morning, having left Tinker Cliffs at 4 a.m. to reach McAfee. After the iconic shots had been taken for all of us on the jutting outcrop, we moseyed on down in staggered groups. We knew there was a very famous all-you-can-eat southern food restaurant near our next stop for the night, the Four Pines Hostel, and we were desperate to get there. Four Pines was rustic and great. The owner was another huge character who didn't suffer fools gladly, but was full of kindness and generosity to those he considered good folks. We drove to the store and filled up on snacks and cider, then made our way en masse to the restaurant everyone had been raving about, Buckshot included, as he'd turned up just before we left and climbed in with us. I had my first experience of grits, biscuits, fried chicken and collard greens, stuffing myself until I could barely breathe. No food tastes as good as food after walking miles and miles every day. This never changed, and food never got old. That night, drunk, full, and happy after all of us playing cornhole in the yard and singing our lungs out to music under warm starlit skies, Buckshot and I were as predictably drawn together as ever, moving away from the small group and firelight up to the backfields where we set up our camp. This time, though, our coming together was for more than physical touch. We held each other closely, and there was a sadness and somberness to him as he explained that he hadn't known how to deal with how he'd been feeling. So frustrated that he couldn't stay away from me, yet consumed with guilt and still in love with his girlfriend. I knew he was torn, and I knew we'd had something very special, but the best of us was a long time past. His drinking, rudeness, and dismissal of me since he returned from his vacation had hurt, and even though I knew why he was so conflicted and lashing out, I had moved a long way beyond caring what happened next and from needing him in the way that I had before. I had never really envisaged a world off trail with him, as the trail forces you to only live in the moment. We had existed in a far different and unrealistic dimension than real life, but my heart was still heavy at the finality that I felt in this night. We shared the contents of our hearts, lying under a tree in a grassy field surrounded by the wild woods that had brought us together. And, although we would weave in and out of each other's pathways over the following 2 days, we chose this to be our final goodbye, in the best way we knew how. Chapter 20. Leaving the Trail. I was lost again, trailing behind Maple and stopping often to rest my weight on my heel. When that didn't offer enough respite, I found myself leaning heavily on one pole and lifting my foot in the air slightly, as though I could detach it from any weight at all. It pulsed, the purpley red creeping up my ankle. The many weeks of walking on something so painful had migrated the pain upwards, and now my shin ached with a cold dullness that made me repeatedly and absently touch it with my palm whenever I was sitting. I guessed my shin was crying out to me because the voice of the foot had not been enough. How could I have ignored it this long? My stubborn, bull-headed desperation to be normal and to not slide backwards, not slip. No 2 steps forwards, 1 step backwards anymore. Enough. I was strong now. I was a hiker. This was my new life. I was a person that didn't need to make an excuse, didn't need to take a seat, tell a lie, not join in or meet people afterwards, never admitting my agony. I was supposed to be fixed, and now I was here again, and it was too much to bear. I barked out a sob. Silence. The trees held me as I slid down, hands slipping down my poles, onto my knees then further, head in hands. Floored. My pain has always dived inwards. A swallow, a grimace, and it's gone from view. But here in the forest, I knew there was little need to pretend. The woods knew all my secrets by now. And the grief I felt was theirs, too, for they recognize a broken bough. I cried for a long time, unmoved by the time of day or where my friends were. I wondered if I could just stay here and suspend time until I healed. Wiping tears from my dirty face with dirtier hands, I pulled my phone from my breast pocket and dialed the only person who knew the contours of my journey to this moment as though they were her own. Mum, there are no ends to the intonation of this simple word, and no end to my wonderment of how she translates them correctly every time. Are you okay? What's happened? Oh, Mum! I choked up. Her voice was her cool hand on my hot brow, her wisdom the only possible life buoy to this bobbing, drowning moment. I scrabbled to sound okay because I didn't want her to worry so far away and with so little she could do, but I just couldn't do it. I was broken. Mum, you know my foot? The question ended in a high-pitched wobble. My voice was wavering, and I paused, desperate to control myself. Well, I drew the words out. I think it's really bad, Mum. A little beat of silence, her thinking, weighing the response. It's okay, sweetheart, she soothed, slowly and calmly. It's okay. There was some quiet whilst she waited for my breathing to slow. Gail, there is no shame in this. I bowed my head, but she couldn't see me. The shame. I bowed my head and squeezed my eyes shut so hard I could see stars sinking further against the tree. I can't give in, Mum. Words between the waves of grief. I can't. It's not fair. I can't stop. Why am I broken? Why can't I be good at this? I try so hard. I have tried for so long. I'm a good person. Why can't I not be like this? Tears poured from me, and my chest hurt so badly I found it hard to breathe. This unspeakable and incredulous unfairness. I am old, Mum. I haven't been able to be young like this, to move like this. I want it so much. I can't tell people I didn't make it. I can't not do this. I can't fail. I'm so ashamed. I was wailing, and she was holding the space for me to let it out until it was time to pull my shit back together. Gail, I want you to breathe for me. Gail, listen. Please listen. I want you to breathe with me, please. In and out. Slow and steady. Breathe. I can't help you if I can't understand you. I'm here. It's going to be okay. I breathed with her through the phone, my sleeves pasted with snot, and my eyelids already swelling into my own periphery. What shall I do? My voice so small. You know your body, Gail, and you know your limits. Your father and I could not be prouder of you. We are always so very proud of you, and I've every belief that you know in your gut when it's time to rest. Listen, you can't argue with your foot. You can't walk it better. It's been long enough that you've been pushing through with this. It could be worse than you think, and if you don't rest it now, then you'll be off it for longer, and perhaps any future trail will be off the cards. She paused to check I was there, listening and gauging my emotional state from my breath, and from whatever rich alchemy has always existed between us. There is still time for you to rest it now before you go back, and you can always go back. She was right. I wouldn't have called her unless I knew this was what I was ready to hear. In all honesty, I had known for a while now that my days were numbered on this go-round. I had been growing increasingly exhausted, pretending it wasn't as bad as it was. The pain was keeping me awake all night, leaving me emotional and fragile, walking 20 miles a day. It wasn't feasible to go on. I just needed some permission. I'm coming home. It's the right thing, sweetheart. You know it's the right thing. We're here, and we'll get you back there. Okay, Mum. I have to go now. I have to figure out what to do next. I have to get to Parisburg and see my friends. I have to try to see Buckshot. I can't believe I might not see him again now. This was heartbreaking for me, the ways my heart had broken for this man and all he represented to me in this emotional odyssey I had taken on trail were endless. He was a saviour, cheerleader, charlatan and grifter, but he had helped propel me this far. I hung up the call and placed it back by my breast, breathed, knew and acknowledged that I'd felt these things before, this grief, this loss. And I'd lived through those times to this moment, and so I could live through this, too. As I lifted my head, I registered a less colourful woods. I had been on the phone for longer than I realised, and the sun was saying fond farewells to corners of boughs and undersides of rocks. It was fitting, the dimmed light, an acknowledgement from the place that had saved me. Heaving myself up onto my foot, I made another quick call to the hostel in Parisburg and was proud of how I kept my voice steadied. The hostel owner was coming to get me at the closest trailhead, and I had to get there before dusk. The force of pain as I took a step took my breath away, sharper and sick-making. I retched once, then stopped. Clearly my determination and bull-headed forceful approach to finishing the trail and keeping up had given me some buffer between my brain and the injury, and now I'd accepted my fate, all was revealed. I had been cruel to my body in order to heal my soul, but perhaps it was okay because my body knew that my soul was due some time in the light. Now I knew I needed to get home and take stock. As I bundled myself into Doc's car at the roadside pull-off, she smiled and made some hiker small talk. I felt like a fraud. I wasn't a hiker anymore. I was a quitter, and I was heading home. I couldn't eat all-you-can-eat buffets and feel good. In fact, fuck it. Food would probably never be guilt-free again. Ugh. I held my poles between my knees and looked at my filthy, battered shoes as the truck swayed back and forth over rough road and turned onto highway. I liked this woman and her passion for helping hikers. She got me to open up, and I explained the situation I was in. Girl, I'm a chiropractor and I'm studying acupuncture. If that's just tendonitis, then let's see what I can do for you. And your friends are back there in the bunkhouse, talking all on what they're going to get for food tonight. The Chinese buffet is a favourite, or there's the Mexican where y'all can get a margarita. She shot me a sidelong grin. Yep. You're going to be okay. I asked her about why she had set up her hostel, lulled into a semi-fugue listening space by her kind voice and tales. I was simultaneously anxious about getting to the hostel and desperate to arrive. My people were there. My tribe. My family. Would they still feel the same about me when I told them that I had to go? Would it be like when you resign from a job but have notice to work and all your colleagues become distant, polite acquaintances, the slow reversal of the arrival process back into the land of the stranger? I hoped not. This little group of people had finally got me feeling accepted. The last few weeks with them had felt fun and safe and had given me room to grow. Sure, it had been emotional. Yes, there had been some meltdowns, but I loved them and I didn't want to lose them. And then I was stirred from my fears of arrival into the jolt of arrival itself and slid out of the high truck seat onto my good foot. I registered in the hut, chose a sleep spot, bunkhouse, and grabbed my things, limping towards the single-story building that would hold my friends. I elbowed the door open and was met with the usual miasma of damp, warm rot. Yes, the bunk room stank, but it was so incredibly comforting. I liked this muggy, loamy air, this cocooning of folks whilst they fed and rested in order to head back out into the wild, like bears in a den. The air might have seemed crowded, but currently only Cruz was inside. Hey! He looked up at me, his sharp and thoughtful face taking me in. You made it. Good. Not the greatest day then, I guess. He glanced back down to fish his wallet out of the brain of his pack. Clipped with most people at the best of times, he was thinking carefully of what to say, as he and I had passed clipped a long time ago. He fussed with some clothes hanging round his bunk and then turned to sit on it, facing me with his elbows on his knees. Gail, you have to do what you have to do. It is what it is. You're struggling. You're slow. We can wait for you at the end of our days, but you'll get tireder and fall further behind, and one day it'll be too far and too long and we won't wait. That's not fun for you. I had shuffled towards a bottom bunk as he was speaking, listening to him with my back turned and dumping my belongings on the shiny blue waterproof mattress without a cover. I faced him and sat heavily. What are your options, Gail? He turned to look directly at me. You can push through and keep up, but you'll be in agony and damage yourself further. It's not going to improve whilst you're doing 25 miles a day. Then you'll be off trail somewhere more remote. We might not all be together at the time, and you'll be left trying to figure it all out on your own. No goodbyes. No help. He was right. You could cut your mileage to 10 miles a day and take it easy. But then you're on your own anyway, with people hiking past you every day. That's going to make you feel awful, and your foot's still not going to heal. Neither one will leave you in a fit state to hike or get back here soon. He paused and took a breath. Or your last option, the one you don't want to consider, you end it right here and you go home. You rest. Then you get back here and you make new friends in the winter. Cruz was a cut to the chaser. Whichever way, he said somberly, we'll be gone. He was right, but I was struggling. My phone call to Mum, faint and far away. I might have already resigned myself to the fact my foot was done, but after the ride back and on seeing all their kit in the bunkhouse, I wasn't any closer to believing I had to leave these people. Who would I be without them? Think about it, and remember this. You used to have chronic pain. You could do nothing. You thought it was over. Now, you've come this far, and you're called out again. But with a regular person injury. Celebrate it. It could be me, Maple, or any one of us. It's a trail injury, not a you disease. It's not the same. Take that in the best possible spirit. And, in the meantime, let's get some food. We walked, me hobbling on my heel, to the store. Cruz had been adamant that he needed to resupply because he was going to head out in the morning, efficient and clear. I had begged him not to, to instead take a zero at Angel's Rest so that we could all be together for one more day. We were overdue a zero, the heat and drought making us extremely tired and weaker than we should be. I knew that Maple was keen to zero the next day, as were Chimney and Milkshakes. But if one person went on, often the group would do a slow turn into going with them. I desperately needed them all to stay. A little buffer of suspended animation between the forest and the real world. In the supermarket, I felt like shit. There they all were, my people, filling baskets with Pop-Tarts and Mexican rice for the days ahead. My lack of shopping was a pretty clear indicator that I was going nowhere, and I didn't like it. The next morning, Maple was extremely excited to grab me outside the bathrooms to tell me, "We're zeroing! We're all zeroing! Cruz too! I can't bear the thought of leaving you here alone this morning." He pulled me into a hard, long hug, his hand on the back of my head. I loved this man, this bright spark of emotion and consideration in human form. With the impetus to be up and ready to say my goodbyes postponed for a day, I felt myself relax. I mooched over to the large static caravan with a ramp which served as the communal kitchen and poured myself a coffee, even going so far as to poke through the hiker food box to see what had been left. The kitchen slowly filled with people. Chimney, Milkshakes, Earnhardt and Maple, amongst others. Cruz and I decided to cook a huge breakfast for everyone. So off I hobbled to the mart again, this time with a homemade poultice on my foot. Soon, we were making massive stacks of pancakes, bacon and syrup, handing them down the line to hungry hikers like in a depression soup kitchen. The sun beat down, and the dry leaves crackled in the yard as we stretched the day out as long as we could. It was no mean feat for me to simultaneously research my best route home on my phone and, at the same time, studiously be repelled by this planning and therefore not engage with it at all. Somehow, a vague plan of extraction materialised, involving a long private shuttle to Virginia Tech University, a bus to Washington, an Airbnb overnight, then another bus to New York, and then a plane home. Over 24 hours of travel, for a 7-hour flight to the UK, and then 10 hours of travel to get home to Cornwall on the other side. Crushing. By mid-afternoon, we were squashed together on the sofa and across the floor of the static, under blankets, eating snacks, and watching Lord of the Rings, followed by countless episodes of The American Office. Clothes had been laundered, resupplies had been stripped of their boxes and packed, hiker boxes had been pillaged, and the crew knew they were set to leave as soon as the light came in the morning. Soon, those who were hiking early made moves for bed, and I went along with them, a family set to divide. The morning was sombre and short. I was collected by a quiet man in a black truck, and with only Maple awake, it was a brief hug, some tears, and then I pulled away. The seams that stitched me into place in the woods were tearing, and the rip was loud and painful. I was not ready to go. Later, on the coach to DC, I watched the road skip by beneath me. The ignominy of it. Taking me back up the East Coast in mere hours alongside the route that my feet took me weeks to achieve. Rest stops were loud and bustling, the catapult into real life scalding my senses. The trail had changed me. It had dissembled me and given me back the pieces without a manual for rebuild, as if I should innately know how to put myself back together. I wasn't sure. I was a different human, standing blinking in the city sunlight, and I wasn't sure going home to rest was going to change me back. Part 4. Home. Chapter 21. Back on trail. 166 miles left in Virginia. A series of planes, trains, and automobiles delivered me back to the spot I had left 1 month before. The check-in booth at the Parisburg Hostel. Same, but different. Colder, frost on the ground under my feet. A new trail, but the same one. I was so nervous, prepared to do the next month alone, but so hoping not to. The bunk room smelled the same, and on the shelves to my right as I entered, I could see items I'd left a month before that no one had yet needed. A gas canister I couldn't take on the plane and some toiletries. I raised my head. There were people in here, talking about some other people I didn't know. So, I don't know if he's going to want to zero-bop it. I think he'll just want to keep going tomorrow. Sure, well, okay, but it's super cold now and I'm going to hang out here whatever y'all do. I'll catch you, Spud. It'll be cool. Two women. One young and one around my age, wearing jumpers and talking across the back corner bottom bunks. I slipped in and put my pack on an empty bed. A stranger in a familiar place. Hi, one of them called. How you doing? Just got here? I explained that I was just back and it felt great, but weird. They came over and we sat to talk a while. The thing with hikers is that they'll mostly welcome you wherever you meet them. Always welcoming, all one family. So we got acquainted and went to the trailer where I'd spent my last zero with the boys. New boys were in there. Acid Jesus, bunkhouse, space cake. The hiker treadmill showing me that everyone's special moment in special places was replicated daily by new trail families in the same spot. I was so glad to see friendly folks, and they pulled me into their gang with conversation like I'd never been away, but had just been hiking a little slower or faster and was only now in sync with them. It helped that I'd heard of Boppet in my early trail time. We had been so close to meeting in Maine and New Hampshire, but she'd fallen into a vortex in Gorham with rock naps, spending weeks meandering off trail, exploring rivers, smoking weed and taking stock. Rock naps never turned up and was now a more fabled mythical hiker who would appear occasionally on Facebook feeds in random photos far behind, hanging out with various trail locals and characters. Wherever he'd got to, he was doing the trail slowly, steadily, and probably still stoned. Boppet made it along, though, and was here now, all caught up, lean and fit-looking as hell. So we all ate and drank, and I was mightily relieved to feel at home in a full bunkhouse with the murmurs and snores of my new tribe. But the next day, I set out early and alone, my new friends deciding to zero, which I couldn't afford to do so early in the game and with a flight booked home on the 9th of December. It was so very cold, but as I hiked, I was comforted by thoughts of my old trail family trudging up these very tracks a month before me. A different time back then. Heat, drought, and the fear of no water. Today it was frosty, and as I neared the tops of climbs, the cold wind stung my cheeks. How was I still doing this? I stopped to pull on my thin gloves and put my buff around my neck much sooner than I'd anticipated. It definitely felt like home, coming back to these pathways and trees, but it was changed beyond recognition from the trail I'd left. It had been hard to return to rest in the UK. I had thought returning to trail might be even harder, but my body and mind had yearned for it. What was I, if not walking in the woods now? What was my purpose? The need to get back and finish had been consuming me. My foot had improved slightly in the time that I'd rested it, but it was still sharply painful as I moved up and through the elevation with weight on my back. Maybe it was one of those sprains that meant really resting it. For months. No chance. I was going to hike these last 500 miles if I had to drag the leg behind me like a corpse. I'd missed the beauty of the leaves turning, and now most of the colourful, fluttering scraps of leaf were underfoot, turning into a carpet of multi-hued mulch. I felt less adventurous because I'd stepped off and reunited with family and friends so recently. It had softened me and taken the hungry bite out of my steps, broken the awe spell of being lost outdoors. It would return, but at the moment I felt like a day hiker and too close to the home comforts of my loved ones to feel as brave as I knew I'd need to feel. The cold was doing a good job of hardening me up, though, and the wind would quickly follow suit. Cozy thoughts of tea by the fire with the dog and homemade dinner were soon to fade and give way to the brutality of snow sleeping and iced nostrils. Today's goal was Woods Hole Hostel, run by Neville. I figured I had a while to get there, so started the day slowly, allowing my foot to figure out how it was going to feel. But too late, I realised that the evening had drawn in and night was coming, and with it, the cold deepened. I sped up, feeling a knot in my tummy that was different to my earlier fear on trail. This time, I was more resigned to being alone, but had a different kind of loneliness in knowing no one was behind me or in front. The hikers had thinned out. No one was coming. There'd be no one rolling in after me this evening with a high five and a smelly hug to talk about their day. I needed to be faster and smarter this time around. The hostel sat deep and quiet in the thick woods, a wooden lodge-style building set back on its own track with views over the wide valley below in the dusk. Candles and dim lights on the veranda. No one answered the door, giving me pause. Cars in the lot, but no sounds anywhere, save the cracking twigs in the woods on either side that came with nighttime and the beasts out here. Then she came, solidifying behind the glass from the dim space behind, like surfacing from a lake. "Hello," she said softly, opening the door a foot. We were meditating. She slowly breathed in and then out. Please come in. We will be a little while. Take your shoes off here and leave your pack. You're welcome to look around downstairs, and I'll be back in a while to show you to your room. You're the only one here tonight. And with this, she turned and floated away to a door marked private, giving me a glimpse of candles and a hushed explanation to whomever was within. The door closed. I looked around, feeling off balance and uneasy, and walked into the warm old kitchen to sit at the round wooden table that filled most of the homely space. I felt strange sitting there, so walked back out the way I'd come, and outside. Later that evening, we sat around the kitchen table with her farmhands and meditation guests. Our host was called Neville and was very welcoming, chatting about Buddhism, her past husband, and her new love in India, as she dished out delicious homemade and hearty food to the table. I was the only hiker, and she was adamant it was too cold for me to stay alone in the bunkhouse across the yard, so she put me up in one of the semi-private rooms upstairs for the same price. She was so kind, vulnerable, but with stoic strength that I hoped would see her through this first winter alone in this generational family home built by her grandparents in their youth. I cleared some plates, made my excuses, and retired to bed, tired from my first day back. In the morning, the purplish sunrise brought me almost to tears with its beauty. I washed, ate, and walked out into another day alone in the leaf-strewn autumn woods. That night, I was welcomed at Weary Feet Hostel, an oasis of southern hospitality, kindness, and charm. It was as akin to being pulled into a family home like a long-lost relative as any experience I'd had on trail. I slack-packed from here out the next day, but it was far too cold to hike far, my throat hurting from breathing icy air and not wearing nearly enough layers. I hadn't anticipated the cold spell would become more intense in the daytime, expecting the sun to warm me through. At a road crossing, I called it quits for the day and called Weary Feet, who came to collect me. It seemed the universe had plans in store, because back at the hostel were Spud and Bunkhouse from Angel's Rest 2 days before. They had tried to hike an extremely long day, passing the hostel earlier and throwing the towel in just before me. The kind Weary Feet folk had done a number of out and backs to pull in freezing hikers today. Now I had some hiking buddies after all. We stayed the night, and the hunters came, filling the space with loud laughter and kind gestures, cooking bear meat and eating plate after plate of food. I'd been warned that the hostel might fill with these big men in their camouflaged finery. It was why my hat was orange for this stretch of winter hiking. It was hunting season, and if you were going into the woods, then it was highly recommended you wore orange to not get shot by the hunters who were secluded in hides or up trees. Great, I had thought, another thing to overthink when peeing or digging a cat hole off trail where you think you had some privacy. I had taken to peeing and waving at the same time to make the hunters I thought could be watching know I knew they were there, even though they probably weren't there and I was just overthinking. Still, I didn't like the idea of being watched by men with guns hidden deep in the woods as I hiked along like a doe for the capture. In reality, though, and far from my fevered mind, the only hunters I encountered on trail were courteous and made effort to be as unthreatening as possible, lowering their guns, nodding and tugging their caps at me with "Good morning, ma'am," and deferential inquiries about how I was. Occasionally I'd be passed by pickups, with large burly men sat in the rear, only the deer's bloody lolling head and huge antlers visible to me, propped over their legs and under their victorious faces as they whooped and drove on by. Once, a man with a crossbow stepped out from behind a boulder, making me scream short and high. But he was very nice, and I ended up feeling like I'd met a chivalrous Daryl Dixon in the woods. Virginia continued to be long and welcoming, but exhausting and cold. In Atkins, I took the advice of Wag, who had messaged to exhort me to contact an older lady called Murray, who loved Cornwall and would provide trail magic for me as she had for them when they went through. I called Murray and set it up, arranging to meet her at a gas station with myself, Spud and Fitbit, a girl we'd met on the way when she was dropped back off at a trailhead after a week with family. Murray was a warm, older woman with a huge heart, driving us 30 minutes to her home for showers, waffles, pancakes and any other manner of food or wine we desired. Her late husband had hiked the trail, and she had loved supporting him do it and seeing his enjoyment. They'd remained trail angels in the years since, and she continued to do so after his passing, telling all whom she hosted about her husband and having us sign her logbooks. We were dropped back the next morning, happy and full, and to my total joy, I met up with Milkshakes, who had seen where I was on social media and let me know he could stop by the gas station on his long drive moving cross-country to Denver. We hugged, like the long-lost trail buddies we were, even though it had hardly been a month. And then he handed me his bag of supplies for my new fam and bid us farewell. I plugged my headphones in and listened to the rest of The Handmaid's Tale on my 11 miles to partnership shelter. I felt out of step and out of sync, feeling that at some point I'd have to skip Miles and Yellow Blaze, even though I really didn't want to. I didn't see how I could keep up 22 to 25 miles a day with my foot pain building again and the nights drawing in so early. With my flight and a movable date in December, something was going to have to give. That night at the shelter, our high mood was crushed. The park service had turned the spigots off with no warning, so there was no water to be had. We had drained our bottles to almost empty in anticipation of good clean tap water, and now we were desperately thirsty, with only half a litre each to cook with and drink before we found a source the next morning. We debated hiking on in the dark to the next shelter, but it was starting to snow and we were all cold and tired. Instead, we found a pizza menu tucked in the back corner and called for takeout to be delivered. It was very bizarre. They would drive out with pizza, but refused to bring or pick up any water on the way, no matter what incentives we offered, financial or otherwise. So, unwisely, we stuffed ourselves with hot, salty pizza, played cards and, laughing, swigged some whiskey we had. We then all lay back in the soft, snowy dark, our mouths dry and prickly, wryly regretting our very fun life choices. Early the next morning, we heard cars pull up to the park's visitor centre, which had been shuttered and dark the night before. We'd done the rounds, pulling on door handles and trying outside faucets, but to no avail. In the same moment, Fitbit walked up to the shelter with blue hands and red cheeks to ask for help. Her hammock rainfly had frozen so hard in the night, she didn't know how to warm it to be able to fold it down. She yanked at ice in her hair, grinning and cold. Just for a moment, looking at her, I felt out of my depth. We were hikers, not mountain climbers. We had shorts and trail shoes, not boots and thermal trousers. Maybe it was foolish to press on today. I could hear Spud groaning as she did every morning at the biting air touching her soft skin as she changed from sleep clothes to day clothes in her quilt, letting out the cocoon of warmth from the night and letting in the spiky fingers of Jack Frost. Perhaps we needed to stop and check the weather. But then I remembered how damn thirsty I was and directed my attention back to the lingering echo of a car engine switched off in the still morning. The air was bitingly cold on my cheeks as I stepped down out of the wooden walls and skidded over through the inches of fresh snow with the others not far behind me. I saw a shadowy shape through the glass door, and before long had attracted the attention of a portly ranger who was initially unsure about my entreaties for water, but after a few moments of British accent and my best dry-mouthed charm, he ushered us into the warm to chat. We got water, and once I downed a litre and rallied, I attempted to go all in. I smiled. "Do you perhaps have a cup of instant coffee that I could buy?" This was unfair on the poor chap, really, as he had already shown a shuffling anxiousness at letting us in before ours. But sadly for him, I already knew he was too kind to sell me a cup of coffee, and that if he would be open to giving coffee away, then his nice nature would dictate that he would want to do a little better than what I'd ask for. I mean, he'd already let me in the door, and I was sleep-addled and messy. So, of course, not long afterwards, I was back in the staff room brewing up a pot of some other guy's, who wasn't in that day but probably wouldn't mind, coffee for everyone, including the nice man who let us in. All was well for 10 idyllic minutes, until the boss lady, who had clearly let herself in from the back lot, came through to the office and glared at us all, especially at our portly saviour. Not long afterwards, and after defending said saviour from her cold, direct questioning of why four smelly, dirty hikers were in her office staff room, we were out and back on the trail. Full of yogied coffee and ready for the day. Well, we thought so. Little did we know that the snow was coming in hard, and the temperature, in a freak cold snap akin to an apocalypse film, was going to go through the floor, along with our ability to hike. I couldn't see the ground, my vision blurred by the snowflakes landing on my lashes and the disconcerting lack of depth in my field of vision caused by all the white. I kept up with the others for a while, then dropped back out of sight, as was customary for me. The sight of others ahead made me feel like I was lost, demoralised. But once they were gone from view, I could reframe it. Alone, brave, in the lead. I peed, and the snow hit my naked pink backside, making me jump and start peeing on my shoe. Not a day goes by that one of us doesn't pee on our shoes, but in winter there was much less getting away with it, and secret wees were a thing of the past, with hikers leaving yellow patches like someone had walked their dogs through trail. I didn't like it, so made sure to always kick fresh snow over to cover my tracks. Because I also didn't like being too far behind, I hustled up over some peaks to ensure I could still see the others in the distance. I shoved my hand in my coat and grabbed my hot pocket with relief. The temperature was dropping considerably, and I was glad.